From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I would like to just say a couple of words addressed to our Ukrainian colleagues. First of all, once again, just as the U.S. Representative, you said, hinting at Russia, spoke about the Malaysian flight a second time, just as during your previous statement. Could you please tell us, Ukraine, why haven't you published the recordings of the discussions between air traffic controllers? Or have you at least tell us if you've provided them to the Dutch authorities? Can you tell us?
That was the Russian permanent representative to the United Nations, Vitaly Churkin, at an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council in New York Thursday about the fighting in Ukraine. His comments came at the end of a session called by Russia to consider a draft ceasefire resolution that it proposed. Churkin's comments followed revelations that Ukraine, the Netherlands, Australia, and Belgium are planning to keep all information regarding the Malaysian Airlines investigation classified. This was detailed in a leaked agreement dated August 8th. According to the document, a non-disclosure agreement signed by the four nations involved in the investigation says that the data obtained and results of the inquiry will only be published once the investigation is completed. However, according to the Ukrainian news agency, Union, after confirming this at a briefing in Kiev under the auspices of the Office of the Prosecutor General, Yuri Boychenko, any one of the signatories has the right to veto the publication of the results without explanation. Absolutely. Only after the nations involved had signed and the Ukrainian parliament ratified the agreement, Malaysian authorities were allowed to join the investigation. Ukraine's deputy ambassador, Alexander Pavlchenko, didn't provide a direct answer to Churkin's question.
Thank you for your question. I can tell you definitely that Ukraine is taking an active participation in the work of the Intergovernmental Commission that is investigating this incident. And my government is cooperating in good faith with our international foreign partners. And I think that in the near future, a report of the work of this commission will be published, circulated, and we'll see the initial findings of this inquiry.
Meanwhile, it turns out that Thursday's reports of Ukraine's president accusing Russia of invading the east part of his country, a claim which was strongly denied by Moscow, were inaccurate, the result of a faulty translation. The story apparently originated with Reuters, which has since amended the language to reference the presence of Russian soldiers inside Ukraine. But before the retraction became known, the alleged invasion, which had made headlines around the world, acted as context for this statement by the U.S. Permanent Representative to the UN, Samantha Power, Thursday.
Mr. President, representatives on this council, this is our 24th session to try to rein in Russia's aggressive acts in Ukraine. Every single one of those sessions has sent a straightforward, unified message. Russia, stop this conflict. Russia is not listening. We said it when Russia flagrantly violated international law in occupying Crimea. We said it after the shocking downing of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17, which took the lives of innocent men, women, children, and infants from 11 countries. And we say it today as Russia's soldiers, tanks, air defense, and artillery support and fight alongside separatists as they open a new front in a crisis manufactured in and fueled by Russia. But Russia is not listening. Instead of listening, instead of heeding the demands of the international community and the rules of the international order, at every step, Russia has come before this council to say everything except the truth. It has manipulated, it has obfuscated, it has outright lied. So we have learned to measure Russia by its actions and not by its words. In the last 48 hours, Russia's actions have spoken volumes.
But the Russian ambassador responded to Power and others who had made not-so-veiled claims of a Russian invasion and of Russian complicity in the downing of the Malaysian passenger plane. This was Ambassador Churkin's statement.
The current escalation in the southeast of Ukraine is a direct consequence of the reckless policy of Kiev, which is conducting war against its own people, with the support and under the influence of a number of states. The Kiev authorities have torpedoed all political agreements on resolving the crisis in the Ukraine. The Geneva Declaration of 17th April and the Berlin Declaration of 2nd of July, not to mention the agreement of the 21st February by the current authorities who were in former opposition. They cast aside this agreement, which opened a real opportunity for a civilized solution to the crisis. Now, the so-called peace plan proposed by President Poroshenko unilaterally was only a step in further escalation because the truce was predicated by capitulation of the insurgents. And this against a backdrop of any real steps towards beginning of a political process or negotiations with representatives of the regions. Where is the inclusive national dialogue promised by Kiev or the constitutional reform? Decentralization of authority or a special status for the Russian language. The only thing we're seeing is a fight against dissent, where political parties are banned and the media that doesn't toe the line is banned. President Poroshenko has often made peaceful statements. Just yesterday, this was his comment of the outcome of the high-level meeting in Minsk, and I'm quoting, "The main goal of Kiev is peace. We demand decisive action that could bring peace to Ukraine," end of quote. Now, he also spoke of some kind of new urgent peace plan. Where is this plan? Or is this another maneuver to distract attention while, in fact, trying to solve the situation by force? We hope that the Kyiv authorities will not lose the positive opportunities of the Minsk meeting. And we think that the Ukrainian armed forces, in fact, have trampled on all standards of humanitarian law, and they have been shelling civilian quarters. They're using artillery, munitions with phosphorus and other weapons. In the area of the so-called anti-terrorist operations, there are 4 million people living. Hundreds of thousands of people sit in basements for weeks without water, electricity, food, or any kind of medicine. The overall number of those killed is over 2,000, and their number is increasing geometrically. The number of displaced people, including refugees from Ukraine to Russia, is already over 814,000 people. On the media, you hear about the terrible losses of the Ukrainian army. This is confirmed by the mass protests on Ukraine against mobilization. Hundreds of Ukrainian soldiers, for different reasons, find themselves on the territory of Russia. We give them food, drink. We care for them when we send them back to the Ukraine. We expect the same kind of humane attitude of the Kyiv authorities towards Russian airborne troops that have been the subject of much speculation over the past 24 hours. At the same time, it is said that they were stopped while they had their documents and their weapons were not armed. This certainly doesn't look like an armed group taking part in conflict. Everyone knows that there are Russian volunteers on the east of in the eastern parts of the Ukraine. No one is hiding that. We'd like to see similar transparency shown by other countries. For example, maybe our American colleagues can tell us about what the tens of American advisors who are in the building of the Ukrainian Security Council are doing, or how many so-called Ukrainian mercenaries from so-called military enterprises are waging war thousands of kilometers away from their land. Where did the Ukrainian security forces get the latest weapons? Now, the American ambassador said, what kind of message can we send to Russia's neighbors? Well, I would suggest that we send a message to Washington. Stop interfering in the internal affairs of sovereign states. Stop trying to undermine a regime that you don't like. Restrain your geopolitical ambitions. Then not only Russia's neighbors, but many other countries around the world would breathe a sigh of relief. Furthermore, stop taking advantage of the topic of the Malaysian airliner that was shut down. Until up to now, only Russia has made a significant contribution to investigating this tragedy. All the others are only We hear hints, we hear speculations, and we don't get any full information. Or, for example, why haven't the Ukrainian authorities provided records of their air traffic controllers' conversations? It's still for some reason, we don't know why. Recently, in spite of significant resistance of certain members of the Security Council, the first Russian humanitarian convoy was delivered to Luhansk under the auspices of the International Red Cross. Today, we are preparing for the sending of a second convoy. An agreement on this was confirmed today in a telephone call between Foreign Minister Lavrov and Foreign Minister of the Ukraine. Distinguished members of the Security Council, we have to remember that the Council is not there to disseminate guesswork or speculation or spread accusations, but to find solutions to crises. Today, we suggest adopting the following statement for the press of the Security Council. And I'm asking the Secretary to disseminate the English text, which I will read in Russian. The members of the Security Council expressed their serious concern about the deteriorating situation in the southeast of the Ukraine and called an immediate and unconditional ceasefire. Members of the Security Council called on inclusive political dialogue in the Ukraine based on the Geneva Declaration of 17th April 2014 and the joint Berlin Declaration of the 2nd of July of 2014. In this context, they noted the role of the contact group and strongly urged on the immediate resumption of the process in the framework of the contact group. Members of the Security Council called on the international community to step up their efforts in order to provide humanitarian assistance to the population of the Donetsk and Lugansk regions of Ukraine. End of text. Statement of the press by the Security Council. We suggest voting on this statement now today at this table. Thank you very much.
Meanwhile, independence forces in Ukraine have agreed to a proposal floated Thursday by Russia's president to allow Kiev's forces, which have been surrounded by the rebels, to leave peacefully. We have this from Press TV.
Pro-Russian leader in eastern Ukraine has agreed to open a humanitarian corridor for the Ukrainian troops holed up in the conflict zone. The leader of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic, Alexander Zakharchenko, says pro-Russia forces are ready to offer this, provided that the Ukrainian troops leave their armored vehicles and ammunition there. This follows a statement by Russian President Vladimir Putin in which he called on pro-Russian militias to give way to the Ukrainian troops to escape from the eastern town of Novoazovsk. Putin said his call was meant to help prevent unnecessary casualties and give them the opportunity to withdraw. Let's speak to our correspondent, Serena Shim, who joins us from Donetsk via Skype. Now, Serena, just walk us through this recent overture made by this pro-Russian leader and, of course, the humanitarian situation when it comes to Novoazovsk.
Well, of course, the humanitarian situation in all of eastern Ukraine is very dire. It has been for quite a while, and that has been why there has been so much attention given to the convoys and, you know, the attempts for both sides to try and get in and get aid into the conflict zone. But at the same time, I want to bring up the point about this new humanitarian corridor that has been agreed upon. And one of the reasons that the leader of the self-declared Donetsk People's Republic said that they will give the opportunity for the soldiers and the army to make their way out of the conflict zone is that if they leave behind their arms, because he feels that if they take their ammunition with them, that it will once again be used against them one day. And this also comes in cohesion with protests that were held all throughout the capital yesterday, whether it be in front of the presidential palace or in front of the prime minister's office or the defense minister here in Ukraine, because mothers and wives and relatives of soldiers fighting in the east were calling actually for the government to dissolve and for the main figures of the government to step down, saying that, you know, the soldiers don't have enough ammunition and that they're not being treated under humanitarian circumstances. So it seems now that the Russian President Vladimir Putin may have been able to give that sense of relief to the relatives of the soldiers fighting in the east, more so than the Ukrainian president was able to do. So now we're still waiting to see if that humanitarian corridor is going to go through. We know that, you know, the government in Kiev has stood behind this idea, saying that they think that it, you know, they know that their troops have basically been surrounded and they want to give them this opportunity to be able to get back with their loved ones. When this, you know, initially happened yesterday, when the allegations started to come in full swing that there was some 1,000 Russian troops on Ukrainian soil, the Ukrainian president was intended to make his way to Turkey, where he was going to attend the inauguration of now President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. But he stopped that flight immediately and called for a meeting at the UN Security Council, an emergency meeting. That meeting took place. And when there was some attacks on Russia, the Russian representative to the EU, or to the Security Council, to the UN, actually said, well, we think that the U.S. should not get involved and stop, you know, putting its nose in other people's sovereignty and trying to spread its imperialism. And we even
indeed,
heard
now, Serena, let me just jump in there very quickly, if you can. We did also see earlier as well some Ukrainian soldiers take refuge in Russia because they were out of food, they were out of water, and they were obviously out of ammunition. Now, it seems that the Kiev government is running out of weapons, it's running out of funds, it's running out of supplies. It seems that Poroshenko has very few options left to exercise. So what next?
Well, right now we're going to have to see what's going to be able to happen with any type of political negotiation, who is going to feel that they have the upper hand, and what can actually be done at the negotiating table at this point. If a ceasefire will be initiated, we know that the two leaders of Russia and Ukraine met in Minsk. No ceasefire deal was met, but both of the sides said that they plan on making a roadmap and that they plan on going forward. So now, given light of recent events, maybe, you know, another meeting between the two heads of state could be reached, and some type of negotiation could be reached as well, and you know, some type of way forward at this point.
Nevertheless, the humanitarian situation facing the people of East Ukraine at the hands of Kiev is deteriorating daily, according to the UN. On average, 36 people are killed every day in eastern Ukraine in the fighting between resistance groups and government forces. This according to a new report released by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Friday, detailing the human rights situation there. The total number of casualties has more than doubled in the past month. Meanwhile, tensions are still rising between China and the U.S. after talks in Washington Thursday about several incidents that have almost led to direct military contact between U.S. and Chinese forces near China's airspace. We have this report from the Chinese news agency CCTV.
The U.S. accused a pilot of a Chinese J-11 fighter jet of flying dangerously close to a U.S. Navy Poseidon P-8 surveillance aircraft. China rejected the accusations and is now calling U.S. actions provocative.
The cause of this incident is the frequent reconnaissance activities by U.S. aircraft very close to China's shores. The U.S. always focuses on technical issues, such as the distance between aircraft during such encounters, but then ignores the basic problem, which is the fact that the U.S. conducts many nearby reconnaissance activities. Such incidents not only harm China's security interests, but also damage the strategic trust and the bilateral relations between China and the U.S.
The U.S. lodged a formal complaint with Beijing and maintains its actions are legal.
We're going to continue to fly in international airspace the way we've been, just like we're going to continue to sail our ships in international waters the way we've been. The United States is a Pacific power. We have responsibilities. 5 of 7 treaty alliances in the Pacific region, we're going to meet those security commitments.
The U.S. maintains that surveillance in international waters is allowed. There is no international law that forbids it. But under the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, which covers overflights inside a country's so-called exclusive economic zone, a distance of about 370 kilometers from a nation's coast, there is a caveat. Countries are allowed to enter airspace, but under Article 58 of the treaty, it says states shall have due regard to the rights and duties of the coastal state and shall comply with the laws and regulations adopted by the coastal state in accordance with the provisions of this convention and other rules of international law. And Article 88 reads, the high seas shall be reserved for peaceful purposes only. So the question facing the Chinese military are, has the United States infringed on China's rights by flying too close to its shores, and is it only for peaceful purposes? The incident occurred near Hainan Island, home to military installations including a key submarine base. Chinese scholars and defense officials argue the U.S. actions are not peaceful. The U.S. State Department has said the reconnaissance over Hainan was transparent, that it had informed China. But China says it never received a warning from the U.S.
It appears that despite the reports of U.S. movement towards direct military action in Syria against the group known as ISIL, ISIS, and Islamic State, according to President Barack Obama Thursday, talk of U.S. military strikes in Syria is premature. This was the president at his press conference Thursday.
I have consulted with Congress throughout this process. I am confident that as Commander-in-Chief, I have the authorities to engage in the acts that we are conducting currently. As our strategy develops, we will continue to consult with Congress, and I do think that it'll be important for Congress to weigh in, and or that our consultations with Congress continue to develop so that the American people are part of the debate. But I don't want to put the cart before the horse. We don't have a strategy yet. I think what I've seen in some of the news reports suggests that folks are getting a little further ahead of where we're at than we currently are.
There were huge rallies in Gaza Friday proclaiming victory in the recent war with Israel. We have this report from Press TV.
Palestinians hold rallies in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank to celebrate what they see as Israel's defeat in its latest war on Palestinians. Thousands of supporters and members of the Islamic Jihad took to the streets in Gaza, reaffirming their support for the resistance movements. Hamas supporters held similar rallies after noon prayers in the West Bank city of Hebron, also known as Al-Khalil. Worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem Al-Quds held Hamas flags and chanted slogans for the freedom of Al-Aqsa. Palestinians in both the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip have held numerous marches over the past 2 months in support of resistance fighters in the face of the Israeli aggression against Gaza.
We came here today in order to demonstrate to the world that we are all Gazans. We all support our people in the Gaza Strip. Gaza triumphed, and all Palestine will triumph.
It's a victory celebration and a solidarity demonstration for the Gaza Strip. We congratulate them for this great victory of the resistance by defeating the occupation in the Gaza Strip during 51 days of war.
A leading Honduran community organizer was murdered early this week. Margarita Murillo was a longtime peasant leader, co-founder of the National Popular Resistance Front, and the political party Libre. She was also a candidate in last November's election for the Cortez province. According to her children, hooded and armed men killed her in the early morning Tuesday in Villanueva. She was a friend, colleague, and comrade of our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. We spoke with Tony Friday about Margarita's life, work, and murder. My condolences for the loss of a friend, I guess, also a colleague and a sister in the struggle in Honduras.
Yeah, and we're talking about the savage murder of Margarita Murillo, who was, and she was. Well, it's difficult to know where to start with Margarita because her life was so completely, in many ways, exemplary as a symbol of the, and also of a very real presence in the revolutionary struggle in Honduras against what is probably one of the most entrenched reactionary oligarchies in the whole of Latin America, and that's saying something.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm gonna read a quick slice out of an article that's at telesurtv.net, the English language page of that, about this murder. She was a longtime peasant leader, co-founder of the National Popular Resistance Front and the political party Libre. She was also a candidate in last November's elections for the Cortez province. According to her children, hooded and armed men killed her in the early morning Tuesday in Villanueva. And according to other news sources, she had received death threats before.
Yeah, and Margarita spent her whole life, her whole adult life, and that in itself is, you know, and if you look at the reason I know Margarita so well is because in 1990 she and her colleagues in the Honduran popular movement invited me to do a series of interviews with her, and ever since then we've kept in touch. But the interviews were about her life, and her adulthood started when she was about 13.
Whoa. That's early onset adulthood.
I know. At the age of 13, she was coordinating six rural workers' groups.
Wow.
Her life was very hard, and she was born into a campesino family from her mother came from an indigenous family of Mayan descent, and very striking indigenous features. And her father came from a Salvadoran family, and their history, the history of that family, is the history of so many families at grassroots throughout Central America. And her great-great-grandfather was executed by firing squad for fighting with Francisco Morazan, the hero of Central American independence and Central America, and the symbol of Central American unity. And her grandfather had to run for his life from the forces of the Honduran dictator Tiburcio Carrias Andino in the 1930s, around the time of the infamous massacre in El Salvador.
That's a long history, man. Wow.
People forget all that history, but for people like Margarita, and when she died, she was born in 1960, so she was what, 54?
50 something, yeah.
So
I see also that her son Samuel, at age 24, was disappeared at about 5 years ago, in July of 2009.
Yeah, and that was at a time when Margarita was extremely active in very, very militant, one of the most militant individuals in the Honduran popular movement against the military coup of June 29th. So that was also an extremely disturbing event, but just one of many in Margarita's life, because from the age of 13 she was organizing. She was an organizer from the age of 13, and at the age of 16 at the age of 15 she took part in the big hunger march in 1975 that ended with a horrific, notorious massacre, the massacre of Los Horcones, in which a priest and several campesinos were murdered and thrown into a well. And that was her first real experience of military repression, because the group of 800 people that she was marching with were intercepted by the army, and she had to go on the run for a while at the age of 15. And then after that, she became one of the youngest and most active and militant organizers in the Honduran campesino movement, the rural workers movement, organizing land actions. And it was in I think it was in 1976, a year after Los Horcones, that she was detained, arrested by the police. At that time the Honduran security forces had the Orwellian name of the public security forces.
Right.
And she was locked up. Her jailers raped her, beat her up, broke three of her ribs, fractured her leg, took her to hospital, and told the hospital staff that she'd been in an automobile accident. So from a very early age, she knew what repression was in her own flesh, and that made her a very hard person. But also, and it didn't stop her being a very lovely person, and that was for me. Sorry.
I'm sorry too.
And that was one of the great things about Margarita.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.